Creatures with Wings. Kathleen Ann Goonan. Hunched over his third icy mug of San Miguel, Kyol silently lauded the sense of history and mission with which the Pantheon proclaimed itself on a bold plaque, Honolulu's oldest bar. Though he didn't know it at the time, it was Kyol's last day on Earth. Pool balls clicked off of one another behind him. Blazing tropical noon was only a bright rectangle of light framed by the open doorframe. A warm breeze rattled a ratty-looking potted palm just inside the door, carrying the faint, salty scent of Honolulu Harbor and exhaust fumes from Nu'u'anu Avenue. Kyol jumped at a light touch on his shoulder. "Kyol! Liliha?" His auntie squeezed his face between huge hands and kissed him with the loud smack that had, years ago, embarrassed him. Now he just smiled into her large brown eyes, framed by sun and smile-etched lines. She smelled faintly of sandalwood. The white strands of hair that had escaped her bun framed her face like a halo, backlit by the light from the door. "Guess I haven't dropped by lately."
"No, not since you decided to shave your head and strut around with those strange birds at the Zendo. And you were such a bad little boy," she laughed. "You used to hide behind the counter and then run off with a package of Chinese crackseed."
She shook her head, clucking as she maneuvered her bulk into the barstool next to him, shifting to arrange the folds of her holoku. Kyol shook his head.
"I never did anything like that, auntie. That was Ayo."
He raised two fingers for the barmaid, who clinked a fresh glass of San Miguel against his empty and added another for Liliha. He studied Liliha's stately dark gold face. Though her heavy cheeks sagged with age, she had to be 70, the patrician lines of her face were clear and strong. She regarded him with gravity.
"Sure, Kyol. You twins, always tricking me. Ayo's a big-shot lawyer now, yeah?"
His own firm. Ayo the Perfect made all the right moves.
"So, what you doing for yourself now? Still a doctor?"
"Don't give me a hard time, auntie. You know what happened."
"No, I don't. Never understood it. Your wife dies. That's a hard thing. But it happens to people, Kyol. Lots of people. And how long ago was it?"
4 years.
"Still blaming yourself?"
Kyol opened his mouth to protest, but couldn't speak. The image of Linda arching herself against the powerful Pali winds reappeared as it so often did. She had insisted on driving to the overlook, on the brink of a sheer drop of 1,000 feet after one of their arguments, to clear her mind. She'd sat on the wall, facing the parking lot, then had scooted around to face the valley and got to her feet.
"Let's see if the wind will hold me up today, Kyol."
Her thin white cotton dress, whipped by the strong upwelling gusts, pressed against her lithe brown body. She leaned outward. For instants he could never forget, she looked like an angel in flight. White wings spread above verdant valleys, floating against the brilliant blue backdrop of distant Kaneohe Bay. It had taken forever for the police to come while he sat on the wall, staring out at the air where she had so briefly been. Kyol downed the rest of his mug in one long, practiced gulp. Without asking, the barmaid refilled it and set it in front of him.
"It was my fault. She told me she was depressed. Many times. I was just too busy with my residency to pay any attention. That was so important. Much more important than her. I laughed at her, auntie. I laughed at her pain. I didn't believe it. I didn't believe anyone could feel the way she said she did."
Linda had definitely enlightened him regarding the amount of pain a human could feel.
"Still live in your parents' house?" Why not?
His mother had died when he was little. His father, a Japanese immigrant as a young man, had died soon after Kyul graduated from medical school. Their tiny frame house, paid off after years of backbreaking labor in the dole fields, was worth more than his parents could have imagined. Kyul found its slow deterioration comforting, and the monstrous greenery hiding the house from the street soothed him when it rustled in the ever-present wind. A pink-striped green gecko, whom he called Bess, lived with him, flicking her sharp tongue and skittering across the walls. And it was right down the street from the zendo.
Well, Kyul, if you're not a doctor, what are you?
A drunk, can't you tell? He almost said. At least, that's what he felt like now, though it wasn't always true. The spells spaced themselves out, maybe one every 2 months. At first, when Roshi had been kind enough to take him in, it had been more often. Not that it really mattered to him. Nothing had. Not even, for at least a year, the Zendo life. But it was simple. It kept him alive. He had an occupation he thought suited his abilities. He swept the courtyard and raked the sand in the Zen garden into curves that flowed around boulders. Kyul reached into the pocket of his shorts and pulled out a baggie containing a pale powder.
This is what I do, he said, besides a little carpentry to make money.
Some new drug?
An old one. I make beer. I like things that grow. This is a new strain of yeast I've been working on.
I guess you don't have to pay much attention to yeast, eh, Kyul?
She emptied her mug. Tears welled in his eyes, and he had a brief impulse to punch his dear old auntie in the face.
It's a shame that you didn't keep on with your medical studies, but maybe you're a better brewmeister.
His anger vanished, and he smiled. She was still the same old nosy, bossy auntie. He returned the package to his pocket.
Probably. I take bottles of the best batches to the monks. Roshi seems to have quite a taste for it.
Liliha brushed back strands of startling white hair with a weathered brown hand, put the hand atop Kyo's, and patted it.
I don't blame you drinking beer, Kyul. Not that you ever cared about the old ways, but it's the end of a nu'u. A cycle.
Pele, she has called down fire. Not some little beach fire to cook fish on. It will be big. She's mad. Damned mad.
Kyul had heard her superstition since he was a baby. Pele, the volcano goddess with her wild, long, lava-black hair, was always mad about something.
Come, she slid from her stool. I want you to meet someone.
Why not? Kyul picked up his bag of groceries, economy-size peanut butter, Wonder Bread, and shoyu. Once they were out on the street, he followed the old woman toward Diamond Head. Enveloped by the heat and the roar of traffic, they passed the Hukilau, one of Kyo's favorite bars, one in a long string of favorite bars. He almost dropped out of the trek in favor of another cold beer, but wasn't this the place that he'd gotten in a fight with some Koreans a few nights back?
Yeah.
Flashing lights as an ambulance took the Korean to Queen's Hospital, and he slipped down an alley, eluding the police. He had a knack for starting arguments, even though he was sure that he hadn't said much of anything. He never did. Anyway, Liliha strode down the sidewalk with surprising speed, showing no sign of wanting to stop. In 45 minutes, they were in Waikiki. Condos loomed overhead. Haole and Japanese tourists swarmed the streets, clad in flower print imitation of a culture which never existed. He followed Liliha as she turned off King Street. Soon they came to a canal Kyul had not been to before. It shimmered quietly, a stark contrast to the bustling streets a few blocks over. Liliha entered a warren of branching docks holding sheds, houses, and tiny islands within their arms. Finally, she stopped,
This is the one.
She walked up to the door of a sagging white frame house supported by pilings jutting from slow-moving water. The sounds of the city were gone. He heard instead susurrating surf and the omnipresent click of palm fronds in the light trade wind. Liliha knocked, but did not wait for an answer. She motioned him inside, where light leaked into a dim, cool room through pulled blinds.
Kalihi?
As Kyo's eyes adjusted, he saw a room where ancient Hawaiian fish hooks and stone-pounding tools mixed casually with an old lady's overstuffed, lace-protected chairs. An unusual midnight blue chunk of lava caught his attention. He had never seen lava that color, but just as he touched it, he heard Auntie say,
"There you are, you stubborn old lady." "I'm not stubborn, only hard of hearing," someone said.
Kyo followed the voices onto the deeply shadowed back porch. Kalihi, who looked Hawaiian, nodded at him as he stepped into her cool oasis. Unlike Liliha, she was thin, but she too was Hawaiian tall. Her face was an intense thin blade, almost mask-like, lit by blazing eyes so black they might be blue. Hair more shockingly white than Liliha's flowed over her shoulders as she stood on one of the tatami mats covering her porch floor. Her spare, focused stillness put Kyo in mind of a heron at work. The heavy, sweet scent of plumeria blossoms mingled with salt. The thin blue line of the sea lay beyond. A tea of poi, lomi-lomi salmon, and taro broth arranged for three, and a flask of sake sat on a low black table.
"Sit," she gestured toward cushions.
After dropping onto her cushion, quite easily, for such an ancient-looking woman, she stared straight at Kyo, smiled, and poured him a tiny glass of sake, her long, elegant fingers a ballet of unconscious grace augmented by the flowing Asian sleeves of her black garment. They watched surf dance through a frame of palm trees all afternoon, but when Kyo finally left, he couldn't remember what had been said as he rode the bus back to Nu'u'anu. Yet he felt immense peace. As the small houses and neighborhood Chinese restaurants on every block caught the evening light, the scent of wok-stirred garlic and ginger blew through the open windows. He rested in the cleansed, bright aftermath of the day, more at peace than he'd been in years. He had felt that way after seeing Liliha ever since he was a child, no matter how annoying she could be. But all too soon, the thoughts she had interrupted in the pantheon returned. He was a Zen monk now? He was fooling nobody. He wasn't fit to be a monk, any more than he had been fit to be a doctor or a husband. Now the bus started and stopped in loud grinding fits. The sun hurt his eyes even through his sunglasses. He felt old and stupid, and the fact that he'd left his bread and shoyu at that woman's house was proof of his innate, habitual irresponsibility. His familiar desolation returned. Meaning could drop out of life with frightening ease, leaving just the dead frame. Those glimmers of wide understanding, those teishos he clung, even though, of course, one was not supposed to, would never blossom into enlightenment for him. When he returned to the zendo, he walked the stepping stone path through the carefully raked sea of sand, considering how best to tell Roshi that he was quitting. It wouldn't be the first time. As he entered the inner compound, he stopped. Roshi was speaking to a creature with wings. Not, thankfully, angels. Instead, they were slim, almost emaciated, and slightly blue. They wore no clothes, but it did not seem as if they had skin. Rather, it might have been the shortest imaginable fur, or the sleekness of an alligator. Kyo's breath quickened. He knew Roshi was aware of him, though Roshi did not so much as flick a glance in his direction. Roshi gashod low. The creature gashod as well, then kneeled on long, slim limbs and touched forehead to ground. He, or she, rose, bowed, and walked around the corner.
Roshi!
Kyo screamed as the old man prepared to walk away. Roshi turned.
You will say nothing, he commanded.
And within half an hour, before Kyo had time to consider whether to say nothing or not, much less to whom, he and the other monks were ushered into a luminous ship hovering behind the Zendo. How had it gotten here? It must have just appeared. His doctor's mind, which surfaced so rarely now, had only seconds to consider the scientific implications. He shouted at everyone, Roshi, the creatures, the other monks, then, with a flip of mind, became silent. Why not? What did he have to lose? Getting upset was almost laughable. The creatures settled them on couches and prepared them for the journey with gentle gestures. Then, he knew nothing save for his brief memory until the group of monks woke alone in their new little colony. How much later was it? Earth was a cinder, Roshi said. Time was no longer a thing they could comprehend, and they had only themselves. The monks, eyes downcast, hands clasped, walked with slow, measured steps in ritual kinghing. Now the light was dim, but soon it would sear the bleak landscape. Kyo reached his cushion and sat. One, he counted. One. The disturbing creatures were there in his thoughts once more, creatures with wings. Their elongated bodies were delicate. Two sets of opposing digits were on each hand. One was a sharp yet supremely flexible set, which could reach inside delicate machinery and set it to rights. The other, shorter and three-jointed, was suitable for most other tasks. Kyo concentrated on one isolated image. He had wakened briefly to those fingers touching his face, to eyes which did not look directly at him, but were instead concentrated on a task which sounded metallic to his sleep-drenched brain. Perhaps the mechanism which kept him alive during the journey, which must have taken several lifetimes, had needed some adjustment. That impression was surrounded by darkness. It was all he had. His thoughts jumped to his fellow monks. Geckos. Insects. Couldn't they see how everything had changed? Didn't they care? Whack! Roshi hit him on the back. He straightened. One. One. Later in the garden, Kyo struggled with a huge watering can in the garden. Itchy sweat trickled beneath his white garment. He set the can down and wiped his face. He wanted a beer. He arched his back to relieve the pain and endured his useless memories of the bars of Honolulu. Pain is awakening, he mimicked Roshi. Crap. If he'd never gone to the Zendo, he'd be blessedly dead now and pain-free. They'd been here for what he called months. They'd awakened in this small compound, ready, it seemed, for inhabitants, with growing plants that flourished in the hot wind, which seemed to provide them with enough food. He hadn't noticed any indication of nutritional deficiencies. To the contrary, they all seemed hardy. Their garden was large enough for their number, 20 monks. The vegetables were somewhat familiar, a tuberous, starchy knob they called hasa, and a chewy leaf they called lettuce, more sustaining than earth lettuce. Two types of trees bore fruit. The grains could be cooked or ground into a flour for noodles. They required only water from the spring, which spouted like a miracle in its tiny blue rock pool. Kyo pulled slim metal rods from their sockets and carried the awning to its next post. The plants had to be shaded, or they would burn. Kyo complained to himself once again that, though he could brew some beer with these ingredients, there wasn't enough to spare after the noodles were made. He considered once again how to enlarge the garden. Kyo could tell that Roshi was behind him. He stood and wiped his hands. "When will we see them?" he demanded.
"See who?"
"The winged ones who brought us here.
You know that I saw them. You allowed this. We had no choice. The other monks may accept everything you say, but you are no holier than I am, no more great, no more full of Buddha mind."
Roshi's eyes glimmered with fun. The hint of a smile touched his face.
"You are doing well, Kyo. Quite well. Remember when you came to the Zendo? Too weak to want to live at all, much less argue with a Roshi."
He gushed and strode off, leaving Kyo angry and still wanting a beer. The precious packet of yeast he had shown Liliha had remained in his pocket during the voyage. It frustrated him to see the smooth, promising powder, so he kept the bag under his mat, where he wouldn't have to look at it. The resources here were meager, and he needed to start exploring if he wanted to brew beer.
"Have you seen them?"
Kyo asked that night as he tossed on his mat, sleepless.
"Who?" asked Riku. His tone of voice did not invite conversation.
"The creatures with wings, the beautiful ones who brought us here."
"Roshi brought us here."
"Where do you think you are, anyway? Earth?" Kyo was getting angry again. He always did when Riku acted this way.
"Earth is ruined, burned. Why didn't we burn with it?"
Riku sighed.
"We have to get up in 3 hours. Does it matter where we are? We have food and water."
"Right. Some bowls, some watering cans, some cook pots. It's like a penal colony."
"It's an endless session, an opportunity. We have our minds. We can do zazen. We can achieve enlightenment."
He rolled over. "Why is my mind so much different than his mind?" wondered Kyo. He stared into the darkness and once more apologized to Ayo.
"Well, Ayo, it's like this. You worked hard and did everything Dad wanted you to do, and you're dead. I was a worthless son of a bitch, so inhuman that I drove my wife crazy, a deadbeat and a drunk, and I'm alive. Hey, does it make sense to you?"
Tears welled up and overflowed onto his cheeks.
"I've got tears in my ears from lying on my back in bed and crying over you."
Was that how it went? He'd never cried when he could drink. Emotions had to come out sometime, somehow, medical dogma claimed, but he tried to postpone that time until someone knocked him over the head in a dark alley and killed him. He hummed the tune, then chortled. Riku made a sour warning snort.
"Silence, O revered Bodhisattva Riku!"
Kyo laughed until the laughs turned into long, ragged sobs, which Riku, as usual, ignored. And after that, just before sleep, there was a slight clean time in his mind. The image of the winged one he had seen with Roshi appeared. The eyes were violet. They seemed deep and sad, but Kyo doubted that emotion was for them as it was for him. The head was an irregular ellipsoid, and he could tell no sex. The wings themselves were pale, streaked with luminescent color, and arched high over the shoulders of the slim being, who stood monk straight in the rock garden in the Zendo on Nu'u'anu Avenue. And he was not looking at Kyo, but at Roshi, who nodded once. The next morning, as Kyo sat, a small light grew within him until it swallowed the darkness. It was gentle, but insistent, and he could find no center to it. He let it engulf that which was looking for a center. When he opened his eyes, all the other monks were gone. In front of him, on the floor, wobbling in the hot breeze, was a leaf-shaped, stiff piece of thin, almost transparent color. Just a piece of color. Almost breathless, he reached out and found it rough and dry, the texture of an old seed pod. He put it in his pocket and rose. He had missed breakfast.
"It isn't my Buddha mind that's taking me, Roshi. It's my human mind," shouted Kyo. "I'm going crazy."
"They are the same," replied Roshi. He handed Kyo a flask of water. "Please turn back at midday. Then the next time you can try a different direction. If you continue until night and find no water, you are dead."
Kyo shrugged.
"Please return." So Kyo did. He explored 7 vectors as best he could tell, returning for 7 nights with the empty flask and the bag of yeast he always took, his talisman, his only piece of earth. He also took the piece of color. It was a rich rose, shot through with narrow streaks of olive green.
"There's nothing out there," he said, "nothing but lava, blue, shiny, glittery lava. I'll just have to go for a whole day."
On the 8th day, he took the awkward watering can as well. He lashed a thin, rolled-up sleeping mat to his back and included a good supply of dried noodles, which could soak in his drinking water. As usual, he could not interpret the look in Roshi's eyes as they stood on the edge of their little encampment.
"Remember your bodhisattva vow," he said.
"No matter how numberless the beings, I vow to enlighten them all."
"Make that the source of your every thought and action," Roshi said, then turned away.
On the 2nd day, he found the body. It was desiccated. It hadn't rotted. It had dried. Kyo had lost a good deal of his water supply to evaporation and had been thinking of turning back. Now he changed his mind. He squatted and examined the dead creature. All the color had gone out of its wings. He flaked away long, thin scales of translucent, mica-like material. Thin, bony limbs fitted close to its body, as if it had been very cold before death. That night, Kyo slept in a smooth, volcanic hollow, its glass hardness softened little by his mat. When he woke, it was to deep violet eyes, compassionate and sad. The wings were backlit by sunlight, and colors sped across their surface, brilliant, elusive. Its skin was dull olive, fantastic digits folded in a complex arrangement as it held its hands at the center of its chest. Its entire heart and mind entered its plea, which was precise and unmistakable.
"Help us."
"How?" Kyo found himself asking silently, forming the question with a telepathic facility he had not known he possessed.
"Come."
Kyo rose, rolled his mat, adjusted his robes. Hoisting his burden, he followed the creature as their shadows grew even shorter. Kyo's attempts to communicate with it frustrated him. He tried to find the space from which he had spontaneously asked how, but could not. Or perhaps he did, and the creature was not in a conversational mood. It strode before him, perfectly erect, graceful. After the 1st hour, Kyo entered a state of qinhing, walking zen. He absorbed the ropey contours of the lava without thinking about where to step. His legs carried him forward. The sun became very, very hot.
"Observe,"
Kyo allowed his attention to shift into sight. Startled, he saw mountains where there had been none earlier in the day. The sun had passed its zenith, and he wondered at his ability to forego water for so long. Immediately, he uncapped his water bottle and drank. Then he offered it to the creature, who, to his surprise, accepted it with a grave gusho and drank as well.
"Almost there," he heard. "Buddha be praised," he found himself answering.
The creature looked into his eyes, and he fancied he saw a smile there. When they arrived at the cliffs, it took three winged creatures to fly Kyo up, and he was afraid even then that they would lose power and plummet back onto the sharp lava below. Their wings beat against the air even more slowly.
"Relax," he heard. "Your stiffness adds to the difficulty."
He allowed his fear to be an object, like the cliff face, which moved downward with laborious slowness. Their speed increased.
"Better."
Once they reached the lip, others reached down and dragged him up. Long digits curled around his upper arms like snakes. As he gained his feet and looked about, he was not particularly surprised to see a group. When they gushed as a body, he automatically gushed back. But when he heard,
"Greetings, Roshi,"
he emphatically shook his head.
"I am no Roshi," he replied, counting 19 of them. "You have come to teach us your ways. Have you not taken a vow?"
"A vow?
Yes, I vow to save all beings, no matter how numberless."
"Or how strange and inhuman," he added to himself, before going on.
"I am not qualified to do what you wish. If you cannot give us the transmission, we will die."
He found that difficult to believe.
"If humans do not achieve enlightenment, they do not die."
Even as he thought it, a part of his mind demurred. Old philosophy questions from college, snippets from the Bible and the sutras thrust themselves forward, a small crowd of dissenters. He sighed.
"I am very tired."
They led him to one of many caves. Within, he saw jugs of water, some seeds, a comfortable cushion. He unrolled his own mat and slept. Day was more shadowed here than on the plain, and they had a spring which caused this valley, hanging like a suspended bowl far above the plain, to bloom with strange plants. He woke before dawn to find them gathered around him, waiting. He didn't even reflect on what was happening. He had sat zazen every morning for years, and he sat today too. They all did. Their long, slim limbs easily twisted into lotus. Kyo was finished long before them. So as not to disturb them, he said his vows silently, stood with the merest rustle of robe, and walked further into the recessed valley. Soon, red foliage cloaked the lower portions of the cliffs. Flower-like yellow growths were stark and strong against blue lava rock. He passed a patch where grains he and his fellow monks lived on flourished. He hoped they were watering the garden. He missed them and Roshi.
Roshi.
They meant him to be their Roshi. The craziness of his situation electrified him. His hearty laugh echoed throughout the little valley. They came floating up the valley then and hovered around him in doubtful attitudes. One touched his mouth, the tears on his face, observed Kyo questioningly.
"I am laughing," he said, filled with wonder, delight. He could not literally remember when he had last laughed.
When he was a kid, with Ayo, stealing Chinese crack seed from under his auntie's nose. Out surfing Makaha, rushing shoreward balanced on the lip of a killer wave. On his wedding day?
"Laughing," echoed his mind
in 19 whispers. He set to getting his strange Dharma charges, who called themselves Hanab, into shape. Sitting before his cave one evening, he went over his usual roster of puzzlement. How did these creatures reproduce? Eggs? Cloning? He had no idea. There were no youngsters. When he asked, he encountered a wall of deep sadness. A sadness so deep they could not formulate any thoughts about it. He turned to another constant in his roster. Beer. With the reverence of ritual, he took his little packet of yeast from its cool resting place in the cave. He ran his thumb over the smooth plastic bag, yearning to unleash the power within. He could do it here. There was plenty of grain at this higher elevation. How he wanted to have something to drink. He still clung to memories, and the memory of entering neon-lit bars in Honolulu at 2 a.m. was Teisho-like. He had to let it go, yet it fell squarely into the category of holy. The Hanab thought him a Roshi. He didn't quite understand that responsibility until he did. Perhaps it was best to wait to carry out this enterprise. He had failed at everything else. When he drank, he was able to forget, for a little while, that nagging, gnawing feeling that he could face nothing, that he was worthless. A pleasant little forgetting. Immensely pleasant. He sighed, returned the package to its niche, and left the cave. One morning, he noticed that two of his monks were gone. From beneath lowered eyelids, he counted. Yes, only 17. His first reaction was that of old Kyo. He would wait, see, and learn. But then he was all fierce Roshi. Not thinking, just doing. Where are Tyserilis and Miniel? He asked sternly. Not one of them shifted in their meditational attitude. Not one blinked. Where? He shouted. Then, where? Aloud. One of them rose and took him by the hand. He was led to the lip of the cliff where he stood staring. Finally, he made them out. Two tiny dots moving across the lava field. They will die! We must go get them! The creature beside him shook his head, and when Kyo took a step down the faint path etched into the sheer cliff, the creature grabbed him with powerful arms and dragged him back from the cliff. Kyo shrugged him off. Where are the ones who brought us to this planet? He asked the air. The ones with the ships! This tiny enclave existed in the same primitive manner as the monks across the lava plains. They used no technology at all. The Hanab would answer none of his questions. Kyo turned away and hiked up the valley with furious speed. Following a faint path up a side valley, he came to a cave he had discovered soon after he arrived. At the back was a tunnel. Next to the tunnel, on the floor, was a ceremonial bowl of blue lava. Kyo had flirted with the thought of entering it before, but feared becoming lost, falling into a fissure, or worse. Now, brimming with frustration, he crawled inside. The intense darkness was oppressive, but he continued crawling. He determined to go as far as he possibly could, no matter what. The tunnel narrowed. His shoulders were wider than those of the Hanab, and he feared getting stuck. But the thought that the Hanab used this as a passageway forced him to continue. Finally, after what seemed ages of crawling through the dank, still darkness, he emerged onto a tiny ledge, scraped and bleeding. What he saw made his chest ache with joy. A small, intricate settlement blazed white, far out on the blue lava plain, reminding him of a lone rogue white-topped wave on the blue Pacific. Next to it was the ship he remembered from Honolulu, or one like it. tiny, no longer luminous. He looked at it for a long time, struck by the dreamlike quality of what he saw, the bizarre and absolutely outrageous fact of his presence here, wherever here was. Kyo slid from ledge to ledge until he found a path leading down. When he found the first body, he sat next to it for a long while. His heart contracted in simple, unrelenting pain. After the fifth body, he stopped counting. There were too many, each in the same position, which he suspected had ceremonial significance. At the top of the final foothill, before the lava sloped gently to the plain where the building sat, he paused. The place seemed deserted. The sharp, intense beauty of its gracefully intersecting planes, opalescence as they caught the light, reminded him of wings. Linda's wings, as she floated on the wind, outlined against the achingly blue Pacific. Hanalb wings. On what were they meant to glide? The ship was still several miles away. These people can fly, Kyo thought fiercely. They came to Earth. What has happened to them? Battling tears, Kyo descended the last few miles until he came to the wall surrounding the buildings. A frieze along the top, about a half meter high, depicted an astounding assortment of beings. As the sky lost light, Kyo circumnavigated the city, scrutinizing the graphics. He saw what he realized were the developmental stages of one species after another, as from one of his old biology texts, depicted with salmon pink stone inlaid on polished blue lava. Each series of pictures ended with a schema of a solar system and tiny, intricate signs, which he assumed was the Hanalb written language. Directions? A final winged Hanalb divided each segment from the next like a period. Once Kyo understood, he moved frantically around the wall, searching for the pictorial statement which would show him the developmental stages of the Hanalb. He found none. There was only the winged Hanalb at the end of each and every series. He was overwhelmed by the number of beings with which the Hanalb were apparently familiar, beings which crawled, swam, or ambulated on oddly shaped limbs covered with fur, scales, skin, beholding life through eyes which dazzled by force of their sheer variety. Then he found the human segment. All the phases of reproduction were painstakingly shown. Each stage of growth was portrayed. He recognized a Tibetan monk, a Catholic nun, a tall black woman dressed in ritual garb he did not recognize. He pressed his hand against the large graven earth. The polished blue surface was cold. Asia was just a rough edge. Hawaii, a tiny string of dots. Next to that, unmistakably, a nun sat in zazen, followed by a winged Hanalb sitting in lotus. Enough! He shouted. He hoisted himself over the wall and dropped onto a narrow street of polished lava. Yes, the city was empty, eerily quiet. He swiftly passed two streets and crossed courtyards where fountains splashed and huge flowering plants overflowed their receptacles, walked beneath tiered balconies, and searched the open abodes for signs of life. He could see the ship beyond the city, glowing blue in the last reflected rays of light. He imagined, briefly, climbing inside, seeing controls which he couldn't master, yet somehow doing it and setting a course for... where? Where? The question reverberated through his being, filling him with melancholy which hit with inescapable force. Then someone called his name from the shadows in a faint, raspy voice. Kyo! Long used to the mind speech of the Hanalb, he turned. waited for a long, silent moment.
Come!
Kyo wanted to turn and run, back to his tunnel, back to his cave, back to his safe sangha. But the voice held him. It was human.
Who is it?
He asked, but the words came out like rusty water from an unprimed pump. He cleared his throat.
Who is it?
He demanded, sternly. Odd authority flooded him. Receiving no reply, he stepped, and then more boldly still, strode toward the source of the voice. He entered an intricately tiled courtyard, smooth and heat-holding in evening's sudden coolness. Though the light was dim, he saw a hanab propped against the wall, obviously weak and barely able to speak. He knelt and examined the face. Memories surfaced. The Pantheon, a place in Honolulu that had refreshed him. A talk more mind speech than words, a testing of his depths.
Kalihi?
He was chilled to realize that, though some metamorphosis had taken place, he did indeed recognize his auntie's friend. Kyo gazed for a long moment on this hanab, trying to see which elements gave him such certainty. A set of head, the way her features meshed, the blade-like face, which was mostly nose, the strong, pure glance, which, though suffused with suffering, conveyed a deep, universal amusement with existence and herself as a part of it. Kyo embraced her. Her body felt fragile as that of an insect. Her skin was rough and dry.
But you are human, he whispered.
She shook her head.
Never. But yes.
What do you mean by that, Kalihi? Kyo's voice was hard and demanding. He could tell she was dying, yet he wanted to shake answers from her.
Once we grow wings, speech is difficult,
was all she said. But Kyo had learned to read their expressions, and she seemed to be smiling. Her enigmatic refusal to reply angered him.
Yes, what a joke! He shouted. I was brought here, he shouted. Taken from my home. Earth is dead. It was destroyed by an asteroid soon after you left. You are alive.
She nodded toward a half-drunk bottle of sake.
Be glad. Drink.
Alive? What did he know about being alive? Why did he deserve to live when everyone else was dead?
You drink,
he said, rising, robes whirling around him. He grabbed the bottle and tilted it against her mouth. She swallowed.
Why are you dying? Why do the hanab die?
He felt his eyes fill with tears.
You just walk out onto the plains and die. Where is everyone? I have no one to tell me these things. Please, Kalihi, please! Why did you take me from Earth? An entire race of beings is gone. Why didn't you bring some women? Or at least some genetic material?
He was working himself into a rage when she stopped him with her clear, precise thoughts.
Genetic material. What good do you suppose genetic material is? It's everywhere, Kyo. In spite of that, all has failed. The beautiful experiment has failed. I thought to live here for a long time after returning, to think, to work, but
what experiment has failed? She tilted her head as if gauging him.
Why do you strive for enlightenment, Kyo? Why do you believe that such a state exists at all? Do you ever wonder about that?
I think of little else.
Tell me, Kyo, can you save others with your transmission?
That's what you're here for. Though so sophisticated, they held the strange delusion. He would do anything to save the Hanob, but he was helpless, stupid.
I have nothing to transmit, nothing. I have experienced no realization. Such a transmission is passed from Zen master to Zen master after years of preparation. It isn't passed to idiots like me. I can save no one, least of all myself.
Her silence, in the darkness which had fallen, had a curious quality he didn't understand. Finally, her thoughts sounded again.
There is another way.
After someone has done a lot of work, Kalihi, that sort of thing doesn't happen to people like me. He knew what she meant. Buddhist texts often stated that enlightenment could occur without transmission, or simply, when the moment was exactly right, be triggered by an otherwise insignificant event.
It happens precisely to people like you, and for a very good reason.
He said as evenly as he could,
"Tell me what you mean."
"Isn't it paradise?" she replied laboriously.
"To believe that true consciousness is possible? Even now, even at the end of everything?"
Kyo didn't reply. He felt no paradise, only despair. A moon was rising, so he could still see her face, fissured more deeply than any other Hanalbs he had seen. It occurred to him that he'd never seen one without wings, and he wondered what they looked like. She gazed at the stars, which had spread brilliantly into that dark void which stopped his heart with pain and distance each time he looked at it.
So many beautiful places. So many beings.
She was wandering. He followed her mind on this new track.
The Hanalb have traveled to places other than Earth? Everywhere, she sighed.
And that sigh generated for him a comprehension of the probable dimensions of the Hanalb Empire.
Everywhere searching for the thought, the place of mind that would keep us from growing wings or take us to the next stage. There must be one. There must.
Kyo smoothed her beautiful wings reverently. How could he save the Hanalb from their own wings, from something that seemed a natural unfolding of life and death?
Will other Hanalb come? He asked, his heart beating fast. If only. Perhaps return with answers? With someone who knows how to use these technologies? Whatever must be here. Whatever gave you the ability to... I do not know, she replied.
But her thought was limned with darkness. Perhaps she knew, and didn't want to tell him the truth, or think it, even to herself. Perhaps this was just an outpost, an emergency stopping place.
Kalihi, where is your home planet?
He hoped she would point vaguely at some quadrant of the sky.
Everywhere, she answered without hesitation.
Kyo shivered once, violently, at the idea which occurred to him at that single word.
Kalihi, he asked, where then are the Hanalb children?
Her whisper in Kyo's mind set it on fire.
Once, we were everywhere.
She looked at him then with a gaze so powerful it racked him. In her eyes, he saw beautiful earth, lyric and fine, forever lost. How had he ever thought his own life important? The questions which left him sleepless, who am I? Why am I here? Intensified, until he felt surrounded by a crowd roaring in his ears, within his very brain. Kalihi's wings, arching up from her shoulders and enfolding her arms, reminded him, once more, of Linda's wings, and that they had not worked. Linda had wanted him to be her wings, to simply ask the right question. With a word at the right time, with perhaps just a smile, a transmission of love through space, he could have saved her. That thought renewed his agony a hundredfold. It twisted within him, unbearable. There was no escape. There never would be. At that instant, trembling vision locked with an alien being, he felt the universe splinter and reform around him. New. Simple. Complete. Kalihi closed her eyes. Her wings shuddered. He knew without checking that she was dead. It seemed to him at that moment that she had just been waiting for him to come before letting go. How? He did not know. It did not matter. That was her transmission. He stood and planted his feet far apart. His shout was a force that came from the roots of the planet and found its destination in the hearts of distant stars. In the silence that followed, a hot wind rushed through the leaves of the deserted gardens, and those stars pulsed above. The tang of alien herbs overlay the scent of water from the mountains. That scent of life was replaced, when he passed out through the gate, by a dry, dusty wind that made him feel shrunken and old. He climbed the cliff in the light of the planet's moon, not caring if he slipped. He thought nothing as he crawled through the tunnel and collapsed on the other side. But he could not stop his dreams. A myriad of beings grew from nothing, bursting with life, and danced a rapid, weaving dance while he watched helplessly, unable to dance with them. Then they dwindled to a small, glowing dot, which hung in space an instant before it vanished forever. Kyo woke, lying on his back just outside the tunnel. He opened his eyes and was confronted by the alien sky, tauntingly blue as a mid-Pacific day. His first thought was of Kalihi's answers. Everywhere, their children. Everywhere, their home planet. How plastic, he wondered, is the basis of life? How mutable is the physiological basis of consciousness? He remembered that when he was in medical school, a renegade movement claimed that thought could alter the course of disease. Ridiculed, of course, by him as well as most people. Maybe. Maybe not. But thought, translated into action, into vaccines, visualizing machines, genetic therapies, could. What else could thought do? Time was so vast for Hanalb, and they had tried so many things, that thought into vaccine was probably as short an iteration as an eye blink was to him. However long he lived, he doubted that he could understand, much less master, the technology the Hanalb had let go of. Or at least, it seemed from his point of view that they had. That might be true. It might not be true. A glowing ship might arrive in the next instant. What if it did? Finally, he faced the question he was trying to hide from, the one which had plagued him so long, the Zen koan. What is my true nature? An excellent question. He closed his eyes, then opened them again to the blazing sky and allowed himself to know the truth. The last vestige of an ancient, brave, massive experiment. One called consciousness. One by which the universe had been seeded with hope and intelligence. What is my true nature? Hanalb. He had no doubt that it was true. he wondered what form his brother and sister Hanalp had inhabited, on what far planets, before metamorphosing to wings. He had always thought that all the beings in the universe must be related, often wondered what odd twist of mind poets, artists, scientists, and those seeking God shared, and why. He stood and tried to brush the mud from his filthy robe, then ripped it off and threw it down in a heap. As he walked toward his cave, he yanked clumps of sweet grass-like fronds out by the roots. Sugar. By the time he got there, he had an armful, which he dropped next to his spring. Now what? Yes, he had to get one of the cooking vats. It would be heavy. He headed down into the main valley, saw no one, and was glad. He wouldn't have cared if they had all wandered out onto the plains, troublesome creatures. He certainly didn't plan to. At present, that stubborn thought was all he had. He strode into the cooking area and grabbed a vat. He turned it on its side and began to roll it back up the hill, wrestling it over the rocks. Sweat stung his eyes, and he sat down to rest. He regarded the vat. The huge, battered container was made of soft metal. It was used by a race of beings that traveled to other galaxies. In it, they cooked simple grains in boiling water. His laughter began slowly and grew until it echoed against the rocks, and he was gasping for breath, sides aching. Between the arms of the valley, the lava plains glittered like the blue Pacific of his childhood. But he would never see white sails upon them, or watch fish scatter at his approach in the shallows, and neither would anyone else. Ever. It had never hit home before. Kyo gazed at the landscape with new eyes. Death had shattered him once, but now the thought of all that was gone, and the fact suddenly apparent that life, its near extinction, and its reflowering as galaxies bloomed and died, had been happening infinitely. The incomprehensible weight of it, and its attendant, vast lightness and release, hit him like the Roshi's stick, like the opening of Linda's white wings in flight. He grasped the vat and continued up the hill, pushing it ahead of him with renewed energy. Arriving at his grotto, he righted it. The vat rang like a great gong as it hit the rocks. He bent 1,000 times to fill it with spring water from his small bowl, loving the splash of water falling into water. The winnowed grain spilled through his hands like millions of smooth, dry, tiny fish. The green slush of pounded plants smelled sweet as a newly split coconut. He performed each step, registered each sensation, as if he had repeated them through infinity and perfected them. Perhaps this was all he was good for, to spread the life of the yeast. That, at least, was something. Finally, he opened the bag and poured all of his precious yeast into the vat. Now all he had to do was wait. He sampled it several times a day, thinking about the slow yet inevitable translation of matter as the yeast fed. And with each brief taste, always different, the universe seemed renewed. Why hadn't he noticed its perfection before? One day he dropped his spoon. He bent to pick it up, straightened, and paused. The light pervading the landscape penetrated him, as if the particles which he thought of as himself were loosely connected and barely maintained in the particular form of Kyo. The force of truth cleared all else from his being. The thought registered briefly. Universe can reprogram mind. Mind can reprogram body. We may be the last, but we will not walk out on the plain. Wings were meant for flight, for joy. Hope was gone. Only stark reality was left. That was enough. Koans for his charges appeared in his mind, complete and powerful. Precise puzzles which could cause thought to transform the very atoms of those who experience the solution. Each thought a new pattern in a reformed mind. As days passed and the beer brewed, in waking and in sleep, Kyo's world was filled with light, constant, strong, and insistent. A brilliant power he did not understand and did not even care to. He only knew exactly how to share it. His companions progressed swiftly through his koans and checking questions, which tested each state of individual realization. On the 20th morning, he found the beer perfect. Kyo readied two bowls, next to the most beautiful part of his grotto, where purple and red flowers sprouted from the rocky wall. He sensed excitement outside and smiled. He did not hear footsteps, for bare feet made no sound on the path.
Kyo!
Kyo turned. Roshi stood in the bright light, gashoed, then straightened.
Do you have a question? Asked Kyo. Only one. Can you save me?
Kyo looked straight into Roshi's eyes.
An absurd question. Why ask? I only know one thing. I make excellent beer.
For a moment, all was still. Light poured over beautiful blue lava. Bands of color wavered in interlocking trapezoidal patterns on the floor of Kyo's pool. Roshi and Kyo burst into laughter like children. Kyo's sides ached. He wiped tears from his face, took a deep breath. He was aware only of light, filling the grotto as if it were a pool, permeating them both. Roshi's new wings, as he accepted Kyo's bowl of beer with immense solemnity, caught that pure light and shone.